Scott here with another episode of the History Unplugged podcast. Eddie Rickenbacker, who was a celebrity in the early 20th century, a hero from World War I and World War II, is somebody who should never have survived as long as he did. He was a race car driver, a World War I flying ace, at a time when an airplane could have fallen apart literally any second and pilots didn't even have parachutes, and he faced his biggest challenge in 1942, when, as a civilian, he was tasked to fly across the Pacific Ocean in a B-17 and deliver a letter to General MacArthur in Australia when the plane crashed at sea. He and seven men then spent the next 24 days on two life rafts, suffering storms, intense sun, and being circled by sharks. Today's guest is John Wolkowitz, author of Lost at Sea, Eddie Rickenbacker's 24 Days Adrift on the Pacific. We look closely at what can make someone seem to not be afraid of death, yet at the same time being able to rally those around him to fight to survive until the bitter end. Hope you enjoy this talk with John Wolkowitz. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors. To describe something as death-defying, it's a descriptive word that is so hackneyed you can't hear it without thinking of an ad for a monster truck rally that would appear on a local station in rural Missouri. But when we're talking about Eddie Rickenbacker, there's almost no other word we can use except death-defying. So before getting into his life, can you tell me more about this character trait of his?
Sure. It almost was another maybe overused phrase, more lives than a cat kind of a thing. That was Eddie Rickenbacker, though. It surprised me in my research. I mean, I knew about his World War I exploits and a little bit about the car racing, but that was it. As I dug into it, I found out, man, how did this guy survive to age 20, 30, you know, whatever? And because starting as a youth, he had a series of moments where he just came so close to death that luck was on his side or whatever the case may be. I mean, even in his early years in Columbus, Ohio, horse-drawn streetcar hit him, glanced at him, you know, and he was hurt for a little bit. He fell into a well and was knocked unconscious in that. He had his foot stuck in railroad tracks, and his brother came along and freed the foot as that train was coming or approaching to them. He was pretending like he was a racer, and he was in a cart going down a steep hill, and it flipped over on top of him, and he got hurt from that. So all of that was just before he made it out of school years. And so you're thinking, okay, this guy either has used up every bit of luck he has, or he may be the most fortunate person in the United States. Then what does he choose to become involved with? Auto racing. Now, auto racing today has its dangers, obviously, for the drivers. I mean, we know that. But in his day, before World War I, you were out in the open. I mean, he started as the riding mechanic, which was the racer was in the car steering. The riding mechanic sat next to him and kept his eye on various parts of the racer to see that they're functioning correctly, keeping his eye on the competitors and things like that, all in the open. There was a small windshield and that's it. So rocks that are kicked up come right at them. You can easily be thrown out, which he was in one of his early races, both he and the racer himself, they were tossed out of the vehicle. Obviously, not killed, but still, it was an introduction to a very dangerous life that he had. He just sort of enjoyed that. So that led up to the World War I time of his life. Because of all of these flirtations with death, Rickenbacker claimed that he was prepared to face obstacles better than most people, because he had done it. He had survived. And so he thought, all right, there's not really a challenge that can come my way that with hard work and confidence that I cannot overcome. I can defeat anything tossed my way. That held true in the First World War. He went over. At first, he was a chauffeur. Because of his age, he was late 20s by then, they were his superiors didn't know if he was fit to fly aircraft. Well, I befriended Billy Mitchell, the famous promoter of aviation, and other people, and soon was allowed to take planes up and become a World War I fighter pilot. He joined the 94th Aero Squadron, which became the most famous air squadron for the United States in that war, where he met again another series of almost weekly clashes with the death in the skies. Now, death in the skies of World War I could come from, obviously, the German opponent firing at you, but it could also come from the plane Rickenbacker was in. Very unsafe aircraft that the United States had purchased from France. And the fabric often tore off. The gas tanks were exposed, so a German bullet could ignite that. The aviators at first did not use parachutes because superiors thought that deemed them unworthy or uncourageous. And plus, they felt maybe a parachute would encourage the flyer to leave his airplane sooner than he should. So he was facing death on multiple fronts during World War I. And, you know, I could describe every one of them in detail, but they basically are all the same story. You go up into the air, you hunt for German pilots, you clash, go into battle, and see who comes out victorious. Yeah, I always thought it was neat that this one guy, Reed Chambers, who was another World War I flying ace, who flew with Rickenbacker, very accurate fighter, he said of Rickenbacker that Eddie could not put as many holes in a target that was being towed, you know, in gunnery practice, as I could. But man, he could put more holes in a target that was shooting at him than I could. So you see, he had that penchant for going to where the action is and the confidence of I'm best, you know, which often does exist from fighter pilots.
There's something about World War I flying that when I read about what it's like to be up there in about the most rickety, unsafe plane one could imagine, I don't get the sense of aviation, or I'm not mentally transported into the place of being in an airplane the way I'm reading about World War II accounts. The sense I get is more of free solo rock climbing, that you're never more than a couple of seconds away from dying, and that's present the entire time you're in the activity. Nothing is ever safe. Anything could break at any time. Something is likely to break at some time. Many of them could cause the entire craft to fail. So that alone, I mean, tells me a lot about who he is. But are there any particular moments that really stand out to you during his World War I 10 years of flying ace?
I guess the mission where multiple German aircraft attacked him, seven, and he was able to shoot down two, but then his plane became so damaged that he lost control. It was spiraling toward the ground, and he was thinking, I don't know exactly what I can do. And at the last moment, he decided to reverse rudder, and he pulled a few other combinations he'd never tried, and it worked. And I was reading about that, and I just thought, okay, what's going through his mind as all of this is happening, if anything is going through his mind? You have moments to decide what to try and do. And it's not like he could jump out of the aircraft because they had no parachutes. So that one struck me. Secondly, the statement that he made where he said, our planes were so combustible because over the thin framework, they used a certain highly combustible, toxic combination of oils that any bullet could set the whole aircraft aflame. And then he said, if that happens, we were faced with the problem of, do I want to die by jumping out of the plane, without a parachute, or go down in flames? And I read that and I thought, wow, these guys, as you say, Scott, later on in World War II, there were a lot of safety devices put in, including parachutes, obviously. But he lacked all of that and yet willingly went up into the skies many times, more than the men in his squadron.
After World War I and up until World War II, he becomes a celebrity, which is what makes him be lost at sea such a national sensation. So can you talk about this celebrity period? What makes him become a celebrity? And what is this period like in his life?
Yeah, it started when he became an ace in World War One, you know, shooting down 5 enemy aircraft, and then becoming the leading ace. He shot down 26. He came back after the war to wild celebrations in New York City, you know, the ticker tape parade thing, a big dinner at the Waldorf Astoria in Los Angeles, feeded him for 3-4 days, which included meetings with Charlie Chaplin and Douglas Fairbanks and all kinds of gifts that people gave him. So he became that big war hero, and that's what zoomed him to that those top ranks. You mentioned Babe Ruth earlier. Charles Lindbergh comes up eventually, you know, 1927. But for that time and later, Eddie Rickenbacker was pretty much on par with Babe Ruth as the nation's hero. Then what does this guy do? He decides to get involved in promoting aviation across the country. One of his main ways of doing that was set speed records. You know, his racing days in a car, now going to be racing time in an aircraft. He wanted to best anything from, you know, an intercontinental or a cross-country flight, which he succeeded in doing on a number of occasions. What came with it were a couple more near-death incidents. One crash where his plane crashed into a home, and the wooden log, I'll call it, a timber, came within inches of his head. Another time they were flying across the Rockies and the engine quit. A press guy with him, Henry McLemore, was with him and quite nervous because the plane was sort of sputtering downward. Rickenbacker came back into the cabin and just said, "Okay, guys, we may end up crashing here, but let's not worry." And McLemore said, "You know, the guy was smiling as he said that." You know, it's like this guy, Rickenbacker, was calmed with near-death experiences. You know, the more severe it was, the calmer he seemed to get. And that really struck McLemore. But that all made him a bigger hero because every time he crashed, he survived. Front page headlines followed. And the country loved following the antics of that one particular individual. He became involved with the Indianapolis Speedway. He had raced in the Indianapolis 500 earlier, you know, before World War One, and now he became involved in its ownership and promoting a speed on the tracks. Then he took over Eastern Airlines, and a company that was having financial trouble brought it back to profitability. All those things just kept him in the public eye and made him a public figure, so much so that in this one event where he was eating at his favorite restaurant, it had a table off a little bit away from him. There was a collection of gangsters, New York gangsters, and one of them who had repeatedly sort of, you know, eliminated his opposition, if you want to put it that way. You know, he was responsible for murdering some other individuals. He walked over to the table and asked Eddie for his autograph. Ed Sullivan, who was a famous television host, and before that, a nationally renowned columnist, said in his column, the tough guy had recognized someone else who was tougher. So all those things, he just had that mystique about him that made the country fall in love with him.
You spent a lot of time with Eddie Rickenbacker studying his life, and I'd like to understand more about this part of his character, fearlessness in the face of death. I've seen this described by many other soldiers, and sometimes it's described as a thing that's learned over time by soldiers who build up their courage by not shirking back when things are difficult, and they build up this sort of muscle memory of bravery. But other times I see it described negatively as a person who has a death wish, and there are other soldiers around them who they don't necessarily admire it. They're almost afraid of it because this person seems to have nothing left to lose. So having spent a lot of time looking at his life, how do you best understand this quality?
I think the individuals who have a death wish almost act not out of control, but they don't consider the consequences of actions, and they're not totally in control. Eddie Rickenbacker always was in control. He never had a death wish. he had an endurance wish or a speed wish or something like that. But everyone around him always felt, no matter how tough the situation, Eddie knows a way out. They never feared that, okay, if I go with him into battle or anything else, that I'm going to die because of a mistake that Eddie makes. They trusted his instincts. And so I think that's the difference here with Eddie. He flirted with death. His occupations, the ones he chose, all had a huge element of danger. No one can deny that. But he just thought, I can handle it. First of all, he had handled it, or it had occurred to him as a youth. And then second, he just always had this, okay, I can step up and take care of things when I need to. As a child, when his father died, he told his mom, don't worry. First of all, I'll never make you cry. And secondly, I'll take over. And so he dropped out of school and went to work in a factory. He just, hands on, I'll take care of things. And so to me, that's what struck me, the difference, because I've come across other individuals in my writings about war where they were sort of reckless. And, you know, you wondered if they did have some kind of a death wish, but not Eddie. He wanted to live. He could do more that way because he just never felt that there's a time when I can have to slow down. I'll just keep going and keep going and keep going.
That makes sense, because somebody who didn't think about the consequences of their actions or look to the future wouldn't have been able to keep the morale up of a group that was lost at sea. Which, coming to that period in his life, when we get to World War II, he's in his 50s. And can you tell me what's happening at this time in his life and what leads him to decide to get himself involved in the war?
Yeah, well, he was still involved with aviation at Eastern Airlines and running that company. As that World War I hero, the military, U.S. military in World War II, felt they could use him in different ways. And so they would ask him to go speak to bases and around the United States, first of all, go on a speaking tour. Now, this was within a year or so after probably his most serious crash, the one near Atlanta Airport. And no one thought he would survive. It was a horrible breakup of a plane. So he was recovering from that and wondered, should I go, because I need to, you know, have a masseuse and I need to do my whatever the doctors tell me to recover from this horrible accident. But he decided, nope, I've got a duty to the country. So he went on that speaking tour. It was about a month, 5 weeks long, to different air bases around the country. Then Secretary of War Stimson asked him to speak to the nation about the readiness of American aircraft. There was some doubt whether our planes were as good as they should be. And so Eddie went around giving speeches, trying to buttress the feelings of people that, yeah, the airplanes we're using are good. After that, they asked him to go to Europe and talk to the aviators who were assembling in England for the eventual cross-channel invasion, whenever it would happen 2 years later. And so he toured a lot of air bases there, and at the same time met with General Eisenhower, who gave Eddie one of the only three existing set of plans for the North African invasion. That would come in November of 42. And he said, would you please hand deliver these to Secretary of War Stimson? When he came back, Stimson immediately asked him to go out to the Pacific. And this was the one where the flight is involved with the book covers. He was to deliver a message to General MacArthur. Now, why did they ask Eddie? Because they figured MacArthur was such an egotistical individual, brilliant leader, there's no doubt about it. He would tell you every chance he got, of course. And they wanted another powerful individual to deliver a stern message to MacArthur. And they figured Rickenbacker, being the national hero that he is, could do that. Now, no one knows exactly what the message was. As Rickenbacker put it in his autobiography, Secretary Stimson, Douglas MacArthur, took that message to the grave, so will I. But it most likely was a rebuke of MacArthur for countering his military superiors in asking for more equipment be sent to the Pacific than to the European theater. At that time, most of the greater part of the equipment was going over to Europe. MacArthur didn't like that, so he was making public statements. Secondly, they wondered if he might want to run for president in 1944, and they wanted him to tone down the political aspects of his remarks. That's probably what the message entailed, but no one knows for sure. So Eddie agreed to go out there to the Pacific and drop off that message to Douglas MacArthur.
Right. Without maligning the good things that MacArthur did during the war, he had nearly an aircraft carrier size ego. So it would take somebody pretty big to put him in his place. So
that's exactly their thoughts. Yeah. Now, Rickenbacker, I don't know if he had the ego MacArthur did. Very few did. But he certainly had the achievements to equal MacArthur in the national fandom. So Stimson figured, okay, Eddie can deliver this message and not be cowered by MacArthur.
Well, the fates definitely intervened here. So what happened during the flight, as far as we know, and what was the national reaction to this mishap that happens at sea? Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors.
Okay, they took off from Hawaii to head out to Australia and then on to New Guinea, where MacArthur's forces were fighting the Japanese. After passing, they were looking for Canton Island, a very small isle with an air base, an airfield there. They lost their directions, overshot the island, ran out of fuel, and the pilot had to ditch in the ocean. Now, ditching is where you land in the ocean under control. You know, the pilot controls the airplane all the way down. A crash is where it's out of control. So they ditched. They didn't crash in the ocean. They ditched in a remarkable feat by the pilot, Captain William Cherry, to settle this bomber, a B-17 bomber. It wasn't a small plane, in between some 10 to 15 foot ocean swells, you know, right into the trough, and use the swell on one side to sort of slow the aircraft down. So they ditched, got into the life rafts. There were three life rafts aboard the bomber. Two supposedly would house three grown men, and a smaller one supposedly would house two grown men. In actuality, they were described by everyone there, the larger one, as no larger than a single mattress or a mattress for a single bed. The interior was 5.5 feet by 3.5 feet. And three guys were supposed to live in that. The smaller one they described as just a bathtub, no larger than a bathtub. So they climb into these rafts and get settled for what at first they assumed would be a quick stay on the ocean. Because after all, we have Eddie Rickenbacker with us. The military will mount a vast search to get the national hero back, which they did. But the plane ditched far from the supply routes from the United States down to Australia. Most of the aircraft searched on either side of those supply routes, so they missed exactly where the three rafts were and didn't find them. That meant these guys had to just live for who knows how long. They didn't know if it was until their deaths or until maybe a rescue would come 2 hours from now or tomorrow. So each day was its own brand of torment for these individuals. A couple of them had been injured in the ditching, you know, cut nose or smashed nose, I should say. Oh, Johnny Bartek sliced his fingers, some of them to the bone. Colonel Adamson had his back wrenched quite badly. So they were living in these rafts with all this discomfort. Eddie Rickenbacker especially, because he was still in great pain from that February 1941 plane crash near Atlanta. And he was still in great pain from that. They had basically no food and no water. When they left the plane, they forgot to grab any of the rations that were available. Captain Cherry grabbed three oranges and one other man grabbed one. So they had four oranges as their food in the beginning. No fresh water, not any whatsoever. So they carefully divided the oranges, you know, one every other day, you know, a slice. And then they shortened that to one every day. But they didn't have any food. And after the first week, 8 days, they were in severe danger of not dying of hunger yet. They could last a little longer, but fresh water, they needed that badly. Well, in that second week, the private bar tech, who had a mother, very religious mother, his church back in New Jersey had given him a New Testament to take with him to the war. And Johnny Bartek started reading that New Testament, even though he was not particularly religious. Like a lot of people, he went to church as a youth because mom told him he had to go to church. And so here he said, well, I'll just start reading. Well, the other men noticed that, and some started joining. Two, however, Colonel Adamson was an agnostic. That's someone who neither believes nor disbelieves. You know, give me proof, and then I'll start believing. And especially the co-pilot, Lieutenant Whitaker, he was an atheist, and he scoffed. He said, I'm not praying. You guys are wasting your time. You know, there is no God. Well, the others joined in, and after one of their prayer services, shortly after, you know, the same day, they were sitting there. They just prayed for food. A tern, which a lot of people call it a seagull, but it's not a seagull. It was most likely a tern, about the size of a seagull, landed on Rickenbacker's head. You know, these things have been flying around, and they'd noticed them. They tried to catch some, but never did. They tried to catch fish, but couldn't because they had no bait. And so suddenly this tern lands on Rickenbacker's old hat that he had for such a long time. Rickenbacker slowly reached up and grabbed it, wrung its neck, and they divided that among all of them. They used the intestines as bait, and from that, with their emergency equipment, you know, a fishing line, and succeeded in bringing in some fish. So the food problem was sort of solved, but they still needed water. And again, Colonel Adamson said, it's one thing to be hungry, but dying of thirst is much worse, as your whole body seems to feel it. And so again, they started praying. And suddenly, later that night, a rainstorm came over to deliver some fresh water, and they gathered enough for a couple of days. Well, that went on and on for those 3 weeks. There were periods where they had no water because, you know, they had like 2 quarts of water from that rainstorm, but 2 days later, they're going to need more. Well, no rain came, especially when they were in an area called the doldrums. It's a section of the ocean on either side of the equator, where there are periods of complete stillness. The winds coming from the northeast coming down, clashing, it hits into winds coming from the southwest and lifts all the warm air and moisture up, leaving nothing behind or below on the surface but stillness. So their rafts weren't even moving, and it was unbearably hot. I mean, these guys said you couldn't believe how hot that sun was. They were wilting. Eddie had a hat. Most of the others had some kind of clothing, but they all had exposed skin, obviously. The ocean water, salt water, would splash onto their sunburns, and eventually those would crack open, and the salt water would get into that, and that's painful. And then eventually a scab would form over that. Just repeat that process on and on and on. So they had the sun to contend with each day, and trying to stay out of that was an impossibility. And so they could do nothing but bear that. In the doldrums, I said it was 10 times worse because you're not moving. And so it's like you're on a mirror. A mirror is reflecting all of the sun rays right onto you. They had a little bit of food, no water. They were again running out of water. Well, eventually a rainstorm came and with winds and nudged them out of the doldrums area. That rainstorm is what co-pilot Whitaker, the atheist, said, that was the first of two miracles I experienced on the 24 days, that rainstorm was heading away from us. And we all prayed, God, let that rainstorm turn back toward us. And it did. It, even though it was going against the wind, it came toward us and delivered us water, fresh water. So the atheist is starting to go, maybe there is something to this. So they had fresh water from that and were still in horrible shape because the little food they could get from the sea sustained them okay, but you still needed more. Plus, you needed as much water as possible, and they didn't have that. I thought, well, could they just jump in the ocean and get relief from that, you know, the sun and the lack of water? Well, first of all, there are sharks all around. And secondly, you jump in the water, you get salt on you. When you come back out, the salt dries and makes the skin conditions even worse, you know, chafing and stuff like that. So they would go on the water, but they paid a price for it after that.
When he's lost at sea, this is only 5 years after Amelia Earhart is lost at sea, which is an enormous story. This is a celebrity pilot, and in some senses, the public is now conditioned to expect the worst when radio silence happens. So when Eddie Rickenbacker, who is among the top celebrities in America at the time, is lost, what is the national reaction?
Yeah, that's a great question. It occurred in stages, actually. In the first week or so of his disappearance, they were concerned in part because of what you just mentioned, Amelia Earhart's disappearance. But they also thought, well, you know, Eddie always comes back. Newspaper columnists were writing that. Eddie, you know, he'll never be bested. He'll be back. They'll find him. No problem. The military will have all these planes and ships and everything searching for them. It's just a matter of time before their hero reappears. The second week, a little bit of hedging. Well, I still think Eddie's going to come back, you know, one columnist wrote, but the military isn't quite as confident. So an aspect of doubt begins to seep in. And this bothered the home front because the war news wasn't always very good in that first year of World War II. The Japanese had succeeded in taking a number of places. The home front could cheer the battles at Midway and Coral Sea, but Guadalcanal, where the Marines had landed in just a couple months before Eddie disappeared, at this stage in late October, it was sort of, okay, who can win here? It could be the Japanese or it could be the United States. There had been no land operation against Hitler in Europe by the United States. So the war news was bothering the home front, and now faced with the possibility that their national hero has disappeared, it was like, okay, we don't need this right now. You know, we've got enough bad news. We need some positive news. By the last week or so of their disappearance, the home front had almost given up, you know, because it's been so long and we've heard nothing. And it's right, you know, Amelia Earhart just a few years earlier. And so they're starting to get through what, you know, the denial stage of things and saying, well, maybe our hero's gone. A cartoonist titled his cartoon is, you know, the end of the roaring road, you know, for Rickenbacker. So long, Eddie. Some of the editorials editors titled their editorials. That was beginning to creep in. It never happened to the Rickenbacker family. Adelaide, his wife, never gave up. She said, oh, Eddie's been down this road before. He's been in so many tight spots. He'll turn up. After a couple weeks, when the military was thinking of calling off the search operation, Adelaide, who lived in New York City, got on the train and went down to Washington, D.C., and went into General Hap Arnold. He was in charge of the Army Air Forces, Hap Arnold's office, and demanded that he keep the search going. After all, he was a Medal of Honor recipient from World War I, the nation's hero, et cetera. It's a great promoter of aviation. You've got to keep this going. He agreed to do that. Not only agreed to extend it for a bit, but also issue orders to other parts of the military in the Pacific, broaden your search. let's go even where maybe we haven't gone before. So she kept it going. It was I thought that was a quite neat little scene where she goes in and visits this top general and demands, "You don't give up on my husband," kind of a thing. But still, the rest of the country was, oh boy, on top of the war news, we now likely have lost one of our big heroes. And, I still, when I was researching some of this, that was the time when Kobe Bryant was killed in the helicopter accident. And the national reaction to that, I was thinking, that must have been what it was like for Rickenbacker, this instant national suffering and torment that they were going through with Eddie Rickenbacker's disappearance. So the home front wanted its national hero back, but there were like the stages of death, they were starting to go through the denial and into an acceptance.
Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors. Broadly speaking, how are the men rescued, and what do you think this says about Eddie Rickenbacker?
Well, they at first had kept the three rafts tied together with a line about 20 feet apart. And they thought that, especially Rickenbacker, thought they should stay together because the chances of an airplane spotting three rafts is better than just spotting one in the ocean swells. So they did stay together for the first few weeks. But then some of them had doubts, especially Captain Cherry. And he eventually decided, I'm heading out. Now, by this time, when Cherry wanted to leave, one of the men passed away. Sergeant Kazmarczyk died. He was drinking too much of the salt water. Even if you don't go into the ocean for a swim or something like that, the water is constantly splashing on them anyway from the swells. And he was drinking too much, and he passed away from that and complications from an illness he had right before the trip. Cherry said, I'll leave in that smaller raft and take off. If I get found by an airplane or if I discover an island, I can then relay word of where you guys are. Well, he and Rickenbacker argued over that point for a bit, but Cherry just said, the heck with it, I'm taking off. And he did. He went off alone. Later that same day, then another three decided they would follow and head out, hoping to find land or an aircraft sight them. The co-pilot Whitaker was one of those in that raft. So we now have Rickenbacker in one raft with two others, his friend Colonel Adamson, the agnostic, and Johnny Bartek, the guy who had brought the Bible with him, the New Testament with him. We had Cherry in a single raft, and then the other three, Whitaker, DeAngelis, and Reynolds, in a raft together. Cherry is picked up when an aircraft sighted him eventually, was 2 days later, and directs a PT boat to pick him up. The other three, Whitaker, DeAngelis, and Reynolds, found an island not too far from where an American base was. The island was called Nuka Futal. And just getting to the island was the second of the miracles Whitaker describes that eventually made him believe, yeah, there's something up there. I believe in God. They were nearing the island and looking forward to landing when a reverse current swept them back out to sea. And he tried to paddle toward the island, but he was having trouble. He was tired after the weeks on the ocean, had a lack of food, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, I just didn't have the strength to do it anymore. So I prayed. I turned to God and I said, please help us here. And so he then picked up the oar and started rowing, and he just kept on rowing until he did make it over the reef and into the lagoon, and they reached the beach of that island. On that island was a base, New Zealand Coast Watchers, and the native islanders also helped these three until an American vessel came and picked them up and took them to an island hospital. Rickenbacker's was picked up. See, that was November 11th when those four men, Cherry and the other three, were rescued. The next day, November 12th, Rickenbacker's raft was sighted by some aircraft and they maintained a watch over that raft until night was coming. Now, once night hits, boat's got to come out, a PT boat has to come get you or something. Well, two of the pilots volunteered to fly out and land in the dusk and try and pick up the national hero, which they did. They received awards for doing that. Well, they landed, taxied near Rickenbacker's raft. Colonel Adamson was in such bad shape that those two rescue pilots put him into the airplane, and leaving Rickenbacker and Bartek in the raft. Eddie was afraid that if this plane leaves us now and darkness sets in, they won't get us until tomorrow. We might have drifted somewhere else. They might never find us. But one of the men that flying that airplane said, "Don't worry, Captain Eddie, you guys are coming too." They basically strapped them to the wings because the plane had room for the pilot and Adamson. Bartek and Rickenbacker were fastened onto the wings, and then the other man of that two-man aircraft stood between them, straddled the cockpit, and held onto them. And they started taxiing at sea. They didn't take off. They were just going to taxi back to base. They met a PT boat along the way where Rickenbacker, et cetera, were transferred to that. That took them to the hospital. So basically, they were all rescued by that final search, which Eddie Rickenbacker's wife had insisted that they conduct. So she had some grit of her own to sort of match that of her husband, to say the least. But now they're all safe back in the hospital.
Well, this is an amazing story, and there's so much to say about his life. But briefly, what would you say we can take away from Eddie Rickenbacker's life?
I think that you just don't give up. We're all confronted with problems of our own sort. And he showed that if you keep at it, if you remain confident, because he just wouldn't let the other men give up. He cussed at them. He got angry. And he said, if I can get them angry at me, I can get them angry at dying. And so he was just real big on that aspect. The other main point that I think can come out of this is the value of cooperation. Here you had men from diverse backgrounds, the famous Eddie Rickenbacker to the private Bartek who came from a small town in New Jersey. And you had, wealthy people with not so wealthy. You had men of different religions, an agnostic and an atheist. But they all pulled together in a time of need. And because of that, that helped them succeed. The subtitle of the book is A Tale of Courage and Faith. We had the courage mainly exhibited by Eddie Rickenbacker, although the others did as well, and the faith that they all sort of got from this experience. And every one of them admitted that they were affected to some degree. And so by leaning on those two things, they were able to come back alive, with the exception of Sergeant Kazmarczyk, who drank too much of the salt water. So to me, that would be the lesson. Lean on something you believe in and don't ever quit on anything. Just keep going.
Well, we can see here how somebody who, on the one hand, seems fearless in the face of death can also have the perseverance to try to live and outflank death if possible, no matter what happens. Well, there's a lot more to the story we couldn't get here. And for listeners who want to check it out, the name of it is Lost at Sea, Eddie Rickenbacker's 24 Days Adrift on the Pacific, World War II Tale of Courage and Faith. John, thank you for joining us.
Scott, thanks very much. I had a lot of fun.
All right, that is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.